It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we hit the trails for a look at cross-country skiing here in the state.
First, we're talking about drones. Yesterday, the Federal Aviation Administration proposed new regulations on commercial drone use, and President Obama issued an executive order that created standards for how the government addresses privacy concerns about drones.
The rule proposals have been a long time coming as companies like Amazon and other online retailers express interest in drone deliveries.
Here to talk about these new regulations is Gregory S. McNeil. He's a professor of law and public policy at Pepperdine University, a commentator for Forbes, and a drone expert. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take us through these new rules proposed by the FAA. What did they decide?
So these new rules are actually really forward-thinking, which is something that many observers were afraid the FAA wouldn't do. People were afraid that the FAA was going to keep drones grounded, and instead they've embraced the technology and found a way to speed them into the national airspace. And so their proposed rules, they're going to undergo 60 days of public commentary, and then it might take up to a year or two to finalize the rules and implement them. What they allow are for people to operate small drones, that's 55 pounds and less, in the national airspace, so long as they keep them below 500 feet in altitude, operate them safely, and complete a bunch of administrative requirements, like a licensing requirement, register the aircraft, make sure that they can see the aircraft at all points in time, those types of things. And so it's actually a pretty exciting set of rules for people who are enthusiasts and are hopeful about the commercial applications of drones.
Now, these proposed rules from the FAA have been described as long awaited. How long have these proposed rules been under consideration?
You know, it's funny. It depends on how you measure it. Congress got into the act in 2012, and in the FAA Modernization and Reform Act said, listen, FAA, you need to make rules by 2015 to integrate drones into the national airspace. You could start the measurement or start the clock at 2012, but actually for 4 or 5 years before that, people in the industry were saying, hey, how about some rules to allow us to fly these things? So at least 3 or 4 years, some might say longer than that. It's funny that they broke the rules on a Sunday of a 3-day weekend. It was sort of an odd way to make the announcement, and that's in part because of a leaked economic analysis of the regulations sort of forced the FAA's hand.
Right, and I understand you may have had something to do with that.
I did. I got a copy of the economic analysis online. Somebody actually tweeted it to me, and I started reading it, and it was maybe like midnight, and I was up till 2:30 in the morning writing about it and summarizing it once I realized what I had in my hands. And the economic analysis is fascinating because it weighs the costs and benefits, and it says there are far more benefits from this technology than costs. And one example that they use is that if these replace people who inspect cell phone towers and other electrical towers, you're looking at saving, I think there were 95 deaths in the last 4 years from people who fell from those towers. And so that the government places a value of $9 million per life. Mm. And so they say those are some costs that would be saved. And obviously, that's a little macabre, but the thought of saving those lives is just one way that they see the benefits of this technology.
Now, you said that you see this as an example of how the FAA is embracing drones and the technology and being very forward-thinking. One thing they did not do was allow retailers like Amazon. I think China's Alibaba was also interested in doing drone deliveries. And that so far is a no.
That's right. So the more complex operations that the type that Amazon wants to do are not yet authorized. And so the FAA's approach was to allow the maximum number of simple operations in the national airspace, and then they plan on revisiting more complex operations. So what's not allowed are beyond line of sight. So the operator has to be able to see the aircraft. So that takes it out of the equation for Amazon, who wants the drones to fly on their own autonomously beyond the line of sight of the operator. And it also takes off the table, one of the regulations that's taken off the table is flying at night, again, because of that line of sight issue. But in the document, which is about 200 pages, the FAA's notice for proposed rules, it states that as technology advances, they're willing to revise the regulations. And for example, if Amazon could prove that autonomous beyond line of sight flight is safe, or if sense and avoid technology comes that will allow you to fly at night without being able to see the aircraft.
Do you see this as something that could be, I don't know, is inevitable too strong a word?
It's not only inevitable, this is probably the biggest regulatory advancement in the history of aviation. I think, you know, 15 years from now, when we sit down and talk about this, we'll not only be older, but we'll be talking about, you know, ordering things that are delivered to your home within minutes from a drone. We might even be on 747s that aren't even flown with pilots on board. The pilots might be somewhere remote.
I don't know. That kind of blows my mind. I mean, you study this. Is that a game changer for you, too?
It's a total game changer. I mean, it's I'm so fortunate to be able to research in this area because every day there's some exciting new development. For example, I was at the Consumer Electronics Show in January, and last year everyone was talking about how sense and avoid, the ability of the drone to see obstacles and avoid them, was years off. And then the Intel CEO walked out on stage and demonstrated multiple drones that could see each other and avoid each other, fly through a forest on their own, never hitting a tree. It's think of what driverless cars are going to be like, the ability to see in 360 degrees at all points in time using sensors that never fall asleep, that never lack attention. And now apply that to aircraft, and that's the future that we're looking at. It's bold and exciting.
It's going to be a new world. And along with all of this progress with drones, there have been concerns, some of them about privacy. Now, President Obama issued an executive order related to drones yesterday as well. What did he say?
So President Obama segmented drones and privacy issues into two things. The way the federal government will handle them, which is mostly by referencing existing law and creating better standards for transparency and accountability, which I think many privacy advocates are happy about. And then for privately operated drones, he told the Department of Commerce to establish voluntary standards. And so if a company is operating a drone, they can say that they follow the voluntary standards that the Commerce's office, office is technically called the NTIA, those NTIA standards. And if a company says that they're following those privacy standards and they fail to do so, they can be liable for a lawsuit from the Federal Trade Commission. What's left out of the picture is all of the uses that might infringe on private property rights, trespass, privacy, and local law enforcement use. And that's where we're really going to see a lot of action that needs to happen at the state level. California right now has a pretty good bill on drone trespass, but it needs some revisions. But we're starting to see that type of action happen at the state and local level.
So do you think that what we've seen so far, including this executive order, keeping up with privacy concerns, is it keeping pace with the rate that drones are progressing and the way that they're going to be used in the future?
I do think so. I think that a lot of people who are fearful of the technology think that the laws are not keeping pace. But you have to remember that there's the possibility here that the technology will be more protective of privacy than manned aerial observations. And so, like, an example would be if the police go out in a helicopter to photograph a backyard of a bad guy, they'll also see the backyards of the neighbors. But if a drone goes out to take that photograph, the drone might be able to go out and photograph the suspect's backyard and not photograph the neighbor's backyard. So it might be more protective of privacy. So I think the pace that we're moving forward at is smart, not moving too quickly, but recognizing individual harms as they come up, creating local laws that regulate them without forcing us to lose the benefits of the technology. It's a careful balance, but I think we're getting it right so far.
Now, you said that there's a public comment period, 60 days, and that they probably won't be implemented, these rules, for another 1 to 2 years. Why so long?
Right. So after the 60 days of commentary, which you can do at the government's website called regulations.gov, the government then has to take account of all of those comments and make sure that they're carefully weighing the public input before finalizing the regulations and implementing them. The challenge is that this is an area of distinct public interest, from the advocates on one side to the privacy and safety people on the other side. And I think there was another rule that the FAA put out with regard to recreational use, and it garnered over 30,000 comments. And so the FAA has to sort through each of those comments. So that's what will slow the process down. But I think that, you know, I'm trying to be cautious by saying 1 to 2 years, because that's what the FAA said. It's possible that we might see these regulations implemented by the end of 2015. So maybe December of 2015.
And as they stand now, how do you think these rules will change the future of non-military drone use in the United States?
I think it's a pretty exciting time if you're a person who's into technology, into robotics, and you believe that technology can provide benefits. I think we'll start to find lots of ways that technology will revolutionize the world. So an example that the FAA uses in their economic analysis is that the our failing roads and bridges that President Obama frequently references. There are 45,000 bridges each year that can be inspected using a drone instead of a person. That provides safety benefits, but it also provides cost benefits to state and local government, where the person who would otherwise be under the bridge inspecting can now inspect more bridges with the drone and then spend their time analyzing whether or not the bridge can needs to be fixed. We'll also see benefits in environmental protection. Instead of using mass amounts of pesticides for agricultural purposes, we'll be able to use precise amounts of pesticides, thus preserving the environment. The estimates are that if you can save $5 an acre in pesticide costs, we'll be looking at billions of dollars a year that are saved, not to mention the environmental benefits from using fewer pesticides. And so it's just an exciting new world where there's a lot of potential out on the horizon.
Greg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Gregory S. McNeil, professor of law and public policy at Pepperdine University, also a commentator for Forbes and a drone expert. He was with us to talk about the new proposed regulations for civilian drones from the FAA released yesterday.
Time for Wisconsin life. For nearly 20 years, skiers have gathered to ski across frozen Shawamigan Bay at night. Writer John Hildebrand tells us about the perspective gained and lost on the wintry lake.
In geography texts, one proof given that the world is round shows a figure on a seashore watching the approach of a ship. Because of the Earth's curvature, the ship appears in stages: smokestack, main deck, and finally hull. But the proof requires a ship. Stand on the shore of Lake Superior in winter when the ore boats are gone, and the world looks exceedingly flat, flat and white, and it ends sharply at the horizon. For several years, I've driven to Lake Superior in February to ski across the ice at night with 1,000 other oddballs. Book Across the Bay is a 10-kilometer race that runs from Ashland to Washburn across frozen Shawamigan Bay, with a course marked by hundreds of flickering luminaries. At twilight, racers assemble on the ice below the Hotel Shawangan, just down from the old ore dock. There's a brief Turner-esque moment at sunset when the clouds turn black against a pearly sky and the far shore is still visible as a line of blue hills. As the light goes, the cold becomes sharper. A pistol shot, and the line surges forward with a great scuttling of skis and poles. At first, I'm carried along by the crowd's momentum until I settle into a regular pace, swinging my arms and legs in rhythm to my own breathing. That's what you hear in the thick of the crowd: heavy breathing, the sound of everyone inhaling and exhaling together. It's as if we were all linked to the same circadian rhythms, and nightfall had triggered a mass migration over the ice, like barren ground caribou or suicidal lemmings. If not for the dark, I'd be able to confirm the Earth is a globe by watching skiers disappear in stages over the horizon, except that the horizon itself has disappeared. The luminaries show the way, but not the icy patches or frost heaves, so I'm skiing more or less by feel. Far ahead, a light glows brighter and brighter until it becomes a lantern-lit tent, the halfway point where volunteers hand out orange slices and paper cups of warm water. By the time I return to the race, the crowd has moved on, and I find myself alone on what seems the dark side of the moon. The night sky is so jammed with constellations that the luminaries seem an extension of Orion's belt. Passing a blank stretch where some candles have guttered out, I wonder what might happen if I missed a turn. Would I notice the line where ice ends and open water begins? Or would I blithely keep skiing until I fell off the edge? The thought is broken by the whoomph of a rocket exploding overhead, a signal that the first skier has crossed the finish line. The fireworks also reveal that I'm not alone out here. A ragged line of skiers has suddenly materialized in the shadowy light, all of us moving steadily toward the shore and a blazing bonfire that marks the known world.
John Hildebrand is the author of several books, including his most recent, The Heart of Things, a Midwestern Almanac. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now to talk more about cross-country skiing in Wisconsin is Chad McGrath. He's the author of several cross-country skiing guides, including Great Cross-Country Ski Trails, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and Ontario. Chad, thanks for joining us.
Well, glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, Chad, what initially drew you to cross-country skiing?
I think the quiet, and first time I ever skied was at night on the Ridges Golf Course in Wisconsin Rapids, and it was a night ski with a couple friends, and I had never been before, and I knew within half an hour that I was hooked. It was just kind of a magical feeling to glide along, and the darkness made it even cooler.
And the downhill skiing, people know the adrenaline rush, the thrill of that. Cross-country skiing seems like it has a quieter appeal.
Well, yes. The speed doesn't have to be there if you don't want it to be. And there's obviously more physical exertion involved in most cross-country skiing. You have to propel yourself up the same hill that you get to come down. But going down those hills, if you pick the right place and if you want some thrills, you can have some great downhill ski fun on Nordic skis.
How would you say Wisconsin stacks up when it comes to cross-country skiing?
Oh, I think it's one of the best in the country. There's some nice places out east, Vermont and such. And there's some out west also in the Rockies. Problem with the Rockies is the relief is so great that a lot of times you have to climb for half an hour before you get to come down. And so it's a different kind of skiing. It's still nice, but it's different. I've skied in Alaska and I've had the same experience where you may spend 20 minutes climbing, gradual incline, and then you spend 5 minutes going down a gradual incline. So Wisconsin has a terrific amount of different terrain, sharper and faster hills, and not as many long gradual hills.
What are some of your favorite places to ski here in Wisconsin?
Well, I was thinking, I don't know the actual number anymore of ski trails in Wisconsin. If one would include trails that are not groomed, it's certainly well over 100, maybe over 200. If you include only groomed trails, meaning trails that someone has taken a motorized vehicle, snowmobile, or something fancier, and gone out and set or at least rolled a flat track in the snow, then probably 150 trails in Wisconsin. So there's quite a number of places to go. The DNR does a nice job of grooming a number of trails in the north and central Wisconsin. And then there are some counties like Marathon County and Brown County have trail systems that they maintain along with the local ski clubs. And then there are a couple of full service, if you will, ski centers, Monaco Winter Park, and then one just over the border in Michigan, Active Backwood Retreats, ABR, who have 70 to 80 kilometers of trail that they groom with heavy machines and are immaculately taken care of and are great places to go ski.
Right, and you mentioned the ridges. Do you have a favorite spot where you go when you really want to have the ultimate cross-country skiing experience?
Well, I think I probably would resort to either Winter Park or ABR because there's a lot of trail and they're nicely taken care of. But in terms of just some of the DNR trails that go through public land that are very pleasant, there's one in near Woodruff called Madeline Trail, which is a diagonal stride only as opposed to a skating and striding trail. So a diagonal stride just means that it has the traditional two tracks that you put your skis in and cruise down the trail in. And so Madeline in Woodruff is a very pleasant, nice diagonal stride trail. And then I have to mention the Berkey Trail up in Hayward and Sawyer County, Bayfield and Sawyer County. Excellent, fun, difficult, hilly trail system. There's many, many kilometers of trail, either the Berkey Trail or trails at both ends that are associated with it. They're well maintained and a lot of fun to ski.
How has the snow been this year?
Well, if north of Highway 8, it's been pretty good. We've had early snow. I was skiing in, actually, I was skiing in October. Had to quit for a while, and then in early November, we got 15 inches of snow. I live up in Iron County. So we've had enough snow. It hasn't really snowed here more than an inch or two in a month, but the snow has maintained, and it's you can go out and ski. If you're south of Highway 8, south of Highway 29, I know it hasn't been that good. I skied a little bit down there, but not much. So nothing like last year. Last year was almost too much snow. It was hard to groom. It was hard to pack. And if you went out on a trail that wasn't trodden and hadn't been groomed, you were skiing in snow up to your knees up here and a lot of places in the state, which can still be fun. But if you're going to do that, you might as well put on snowshoes and go for a walk.
All right, Chad, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Chad McGrath, author of several cross-country ski guides.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we look at a provision in Governor Walker's budget that would allow the University of Wisconsin's research to remain secret.
First, if you have a friend or family member who's serious about their Facebook account, you might get this message from the social media service. Quote, Facebook now lets people choose a legacy contact to manage their account if something happens to them. Since you know me well and I trust you, I chose you. Please let me know if you want to talk about this.
So what does that mean exactly? Well, it's part of Facebook's new policy for the pages of people who have died. Account holders can designate a legacy holder with limited ability to maintain your site in the event of your death. They can post a memorial message, but they can't delete your photos and information or post other new material.
That policy was announced late last week. It's a new development of what our next guest calls virtual afterlives, new ways that our changing society remembers and memorializes the dead. Candy Kahn is with us. She is an assistant professor of religion at Baylor University. She's the author of Virtual Afterlives, Grieving the Dead in the 21st Century. Candy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob and Veronica. It's nice to be back.
So I'm guessing that when Facebook first started as a site mainly for college students, the last thing on their minds was, what do we do with the pages when people die? Why has this become such an important issue now for them to grapple with?
Well, yeah, I remember actually I was at Harvard when Facebook started, and I was a teaching fellow there. And so we initially used Facebook as a way to recognize the students that we were teaching. And obviously the students were using it to socialize with each other and kind of get to know each other. So I think initially when it started, it was kind of a curated diary, a really unique repository of visual and written rhetoric, ranging from the mundane to a virtual appropriation digital space in which you could kind of create an aesthetic identity, a virtual avatar, if you will, and kind of a replication of yourself in digital space. So this is, I think, the original intent, and then people started dying, and no one knew what to do. And then you were left with these ghosts, Facebook ghosts, in which the dead people would kind of hang around, invite you to play games with them. They would still suggest friends for you to become friends with. And then eventually, even worse, I think, were their digital trolls, in which you have people who are just kind of being mean, trolling the sight of dead people, writing mean things to the dead, writing mean things about the dead. And so there was more of a need at that point to really curate these spaces and memorialize them. But I will also add that the desire by Facebook to memorialize these pages is also market-driven.
Oh, how so?
Well, you got the ad spaces on the pages. So I think, with 1.3 billion active Facebook users and 1 million pages of Facebook dead users, it would benefit Facebook and the ad users and companies in general that are utilizing Facebook and social network sites as a way to sell their products and advertise their product. It will benefit them to have a better idea of actually who's alive on the site and who's actually dead. So I do think part of this desire to memorialize pages and give people access to memorialization is market-driven and consumer-driven.
So Facebook introduced their new strategy, their new policy here last Thursday, I think it was. What do you make of what you've seen of it so far?
Well, I think it's a great strategy, and I think it's great to give people access to naming someone who will then turn your page into a legacy page. So essentially the policy is that you can go into your settings, you can name a contact. That contact will then receive your information when you die, and you can either choose to let them know now. I love the message, too, right? We might want to talk about this.
Yeah.
Or that contact won't be notified until your actual death. So at that point, the contact that you've given can go online. They can change your profile picture to a picture that maybe you designated or prefer. They can post one last posting, which Facebook suggests you could give them the celebration of life, the memorial, the funeral details for all of those that are contact. And then they can also accept new friend requests so that those friends can gather on that Facebook site to remember the deceased. So this is what that legacy contact does. But I would say that just like wills in the U.S., I mean, over half of all Americans don't have a will, even though they think it's a great idea. I would say unless Facebook incorporates some kind of automatic prompt forcing people to designate a legacy contact, we're not going to see as much of utilization as we would like to. I just don't think, I mean, even though we all know that wills are good things to have, we don't run out and make them. And so I think Facebook will need to be a little more proactive on this.
Now, we've seen even before this, and I think you wrote about it in Virtual Afterlives, people maybe taking it into their own hands. If you're a close loved one, maybe you have the Facebook login, and people have been maintaining people's Facebook pages as a memorial. What kinds of things have you seen people do with those?
Well, a lot of it is what we call sense-making, so trying to make sense of the death, expressing their shock at the death, statements of lamentation, so, talking about how sad they are if a person's passed on. But the thing that I found most interesting is that these pages also become centers of trying to establish bonds with the deceased, the continuing relationship with the deceased. So things that would typically happen, for example, at the tombstone in the graveyard where you're actually speaking to the dead. A lot of what is happening on these memorial pages are people speaking to the dead. I miss you. Life is not the same without you. I thought of you today when I went here. This kind of stuff.
And that's when you were on to talk about virtual afterlives, you see that as a trend, things that aren't dependent on the space where the remains are, the burial or the cremation, but people carrying it with them in the form of a tattoo, a roadside memorial, or in this case, a social media. So we're reinventing the grieving space, I guess, in a lot of ways.
Oh, I definitely think so, Rob. We're definitely seeing that death interrupts us, and that we're kind of reintegrating the dead into the world of the living. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it feels new because it's done through this new medium, but I actually don't think it is that new. Death is a very social event. We've always experienced it socially. It pre-exists us. So the fact that we're coming together in these virtual mediums or even material memorials, so in the ghost fight, for example, or at a roadside memorial, I don't think it's that new that we're socially grieving. I think it feels new because we're on our phone, we're in line at the store, and all of a sudden we see this picture or we read this posting. And so it feels like it's constantly interrupting our lives. But I actually don't think it is as new as it may feel.
Is there a creepiness factor, though? You're playing around on Facebook looking to start a game or like a friend or something like that, and you encounter someone, maybe an acquaintance you know is dead?
Well, I definitely think that's part of it. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I work with death and memorialization, so I don't find it that creepy. But I definitely think that that's part of the problem, that people are on Twitter and they see this funeral selfie or They're on their Facebook, and all of a sudden, someone that they still thought of regularly from high school, they realize has been dead for 3 years. So I definitely think there's this, I don't know, I mean, a kind of collapsing of time and space that we're no longer able to use our imagination to keep these things at a distance from us.
We're talking about Facebook's new policy allowing users to designate legacy holders, someone to manage their site, their page, after they die. Our guest is Candy Can. She's the author of the book Virtual Afterlives, Grieving the Dead in the 21st Century.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered the situation that we're talking about? A friend or a family member dies, but their Facebook or other social media account lives on. And how do you feel about that? What would you like to see happen to these social media pages after people die? And what would you want on yours when you pass away? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now about Facebook's new policy on death and social media. The company will allow a user to designate a legacy holder to have limited control over the user's page after they die.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that's come up in your life, encountering the Facebook page of someone you know who's passed away? How did you feel about that? What would you like to see happen in those cases? Should it be frozen in time, go away completely, or still be live and active? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Don on the line in Brookfield.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. The reason I phoned in is that my son was a very gifted artist. He mentored people at Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, and he passed away 5 years ago. And what had happened with his Facebook webpage was that people started posting messages in honor of him or in memory of him about what an influence he had had on them, what an influence his artwork had had, how much they missed his humor and his wit. And because Facebook did not have a policy for anyone managing an account after someone passes away, I have no way of administering his account, and I would love to be able to use that as a tribute to him, because I'm discovering about people that he was in contact with throughout the world, and it would just be a wonderful legacy to be able to keep his account going.
Don, thanks so much for that story. Sorry for the loss of your son, but wow, what an impact it sounds like he had on people. We'll bring Candy Can back in, author of Virtual Afterlives now. Candy, are a lot of people in that situation just watching a loved one's Facebook page take on a life of its own, for better in this case, it sounds like, or for worse?
Yes, and Don, I'm also sorry to hear about your son. It sounds like he was an amazing man. But what a beautiful tribute. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're finding that most of the Facebook pages end up being positive tributes. I think the problem that occurs occasionally is when people can no longer curate the space. So this is what the legacy contact allows you to do. It allows you to decide. It basically freezes it in time. Now, some people don't like that because they want to continue to be in conversation with the deceased. But without having access to the password, you can't choose which of those posts you want to delete and which of those you want to leave there. And so it can be problematic, for example, when someone, let's say a woman dies and then her ex-boyfriend posts some derogatory comments on the site, and that's upsetting to the family. So this is the kind of thing that Facebook's trying to prevent and trying to get a hold of, and to be able to allow the family, the grieving family, some kind of control. But it sounds like in your case, Don, it's just been a wonderful way to celebrate the memory of your son.
Don, thanks for the call. We'll go to Allie in Argyle now. Allie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My condolences to him as well. I would feel very uncomfortable with my Facebook being remaining open after I pass away, simply due to the fact that a friend of mine passed away last year, and his Facebook page is still open. And since he's passed away, I've had several messages from him asking me how I'm doing. and it's really creeping me out.
Allie, thanks
a
lot.
Yeah, that's definitely a problem that we are seeing in Facebook, and you might want to see if you can contact his family, Allie, and suggest maybe they just aren't aware that they can have the Facebook page memorialized, because what happens is you can have the account either deleted or it will be frozen, or it can become one of these remembering your friend's web page. So what you might do is contact Facebook, one, and two, contact the family just to make sure that they are aware that this is happening.
Yeah, as I understand it, under the old policy, or non-policy maybe, if Facebook was notified that someone had passed away, they would freeze the account, even if you weren't a designated legacy holder, because they didn't have that at that point. Do you know if I have that right?
Well, I think they'll freeze you. They need to get a death certificate. And unfortunately, sometimes it takes several weeks, Rob, and several repeated attempts. So it could be the case that they've been notified but haven't been able to follow through yet, or they haven't gotten official certification. So, Allie, if you can even locate a newspaper obituary with your friend's death, and then that's enough for Facebook to act on the account. But I'm sorry that's happening, because that is the problem with these social network sites. It's a little bit creepy and it's sometimes scary.
Allie, thanks a lot for that call, and good luck in resolving this. Something I noted in this new Facebook policy, Candy, is that if you're the legacy holder, so if I'm the legacy holder for someone and I'm in charge of their site, I can't go through and delete old photos or delete old information, meaning, in effect, I guess, I can't go through and sanitize the memory. What they put up there stays up there.
That's correct, Rob. And so you can only change the profile picture. And I think one article I read talked about how if you had posted a picture as your profile picture, like as a joke or something you didn't want for posterity remembering you, then they could change that. But essentially, you can't go through and curate the site. You can't change it. And I think that's a good thing, because the way we remember people isn't always the way they remember themselves or the way they see themselves. So, yeah, but that is definitely one of the more interesting aspects of this new policy. You can't go through and change or delete any old postings, any old pictures. You can only add and accept friend requests.
As we wrap up, do you expect to see now, maybe with this new policy or maybe just in general, more intentional memorials on Facebook and other social media?
I hope so, because as Allie described, it can be a little bit unnerving. My grandfather, no one has memorialized his page, and people still write on it and tell him happy birthday, and I don't think anyone's told them that he's deceased, and it's a little bit disturbing sometimes to see these messages wishing him a happy birthday, and he's been gone for almost 5 years. So I really do hope people are more intentional about this, and the other thing is, you know, you're digital legacy actually has a monetary value. So it really is something you want to close. You don't want people having access to all of that. And I really think, you know, if you want to protect your estate and your assets, your digital assets need to be protected as well.
And this is just going to keep getting more important to us as we keep using social media more and more, right?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Particularly as we begin to move away from using monetary currency and even cards. I mean, as everything becomes more electronic, it's going to become much more important.
Candy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Veronica.
We've been talking to Candy Can. She's assistant professor of religion at Baylor University. She's the author of the book Virtual Afterlives, Grieving the Dead in the 21st Century. We've been talking about Facebook's new policy for the sites of users who pass away. And you can join in the conversation still with your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page, not a memorial page that is still active.
For many people, life in Wisconsin includes ice fishing. The sturgeon spearing season kicked off on Lake Winnebago this weekend. On their way to their shanties, spearfishers drove over temporary ice roads that are maintained by fishing clubs. Patty Murray tagged along with one of the volunteers who tries to keep everyone safe on the ice.
We might take one out here. We're going to go out here and we might Yesterday we drove out and we had a little crack.
Don Herman knows Lake Winnebago from front to back.
This lake is 137,000 acres. It's 35 miles long, 10 miles wide. It's a big lake.
Herman is with the Otter Street Fishing Club in Oshkosh. For the last 40 years, he's driven a huge truck with an equally large plow on the front.
It's a rough ride. You gotta hang on.
He clears a path and keeps his eyes peeled for dangerous cracks.
It all comes from experience. I mean, it takes years because there's different situations every year, and you remember what happened one year when you had a lot of snow, and you remember another year when you had this crack, and it just takes years of experience to learn it, and it's called safety.
When he spots a potential crack, Herman gets out of the truck for a closer look.
I'm just going to walk up here and see what this is. But we'll go a little closer. I just want to see what this is right now.
Otter Street is one of 11 clubs that ring the lake. They begin the season on ATVs to scout potential problems. Then some fly to get an aerial view. Old Christmas trees are put out as guideposts.
These go all the way across the lake, okay? This is old-fashioned GPS is what I call it. The fishing club's been doing this for years. They put this tree in there. They're out every tenth of a mile. There's a safety marker too, and that's not saying that's 100% because the people that fell in the other day was following the tree line, but a crack opened up the night before. That doesn't mean that it's 100% safe.
Conditions on Winnebago can change fast depending on the amount of snow on the lake, and winds can push the ice around, opening cracks.
And yeah, you are taking a little risk when you come out here. I don't deny that.
And sometimes, despite the best efforts, cars go through the ice and people die. A father and son died in January on the lake.
People are afraid of this lake, which you should be. And also, when you have a lake like this, there's a lot of activity that goes out here. On a good year, and even this year when we get some more cold weather and that stuff, there can be 5,000 vehicles on this lake. And during sturgeon spearing, there's 20,000 vehicles on this lake. So, you know, accidents do happen.
With so much time spent on Winnebago, you'd think Herman would have a lot of fish stories. But he says he buys his fish.
Everybody always asks me that question. Do I fish? I fish with a 3/8 cable.
What does that mean? I don't know what that means.
A 3/8 cable, that means I hook onto a car and I pull a car. Oh, that's my fishing. That's all I fish.
You see, Herman is a mechanic and owns a tow truck service. He's the guy to call if your truck falls through the ice. If you're not a member of a club, that'll cost you. Otherwise, club members get the service for free.
Well, they do pay us sometimes in beer.